aka Sapper, and it's read by Julian Ryan Tutt.
In December 1918, on the very day that a British cavalry division, flags flying and bands playing, marched into Cologne as the conquerors of a beaten nation, the manager of the Hotel National in Bern received a letter. Having read it twice, he summoned his secretary. "Have we ever had staying in the hotel a man called Le Comte de Guy?" She thought for a moment. "Not as far as I can remember." The manager handed her the letter and waited in silence until she'd read it. "It seems a peculiar request from an unknown man," he remarked as she laid it down. "A dinner for four, no expense to be spared, a private room at 7:30 sharp, guests to ask for room X." He tapped his teeth with his pen thoughtfully. "I wish I could think who this Comte de Guy is. Would you send me the maître d'hôtel to me at once?" The head waiter, as he left the office after receiving his instructions, did not share the manager's misgivings. He was a man who loved his work, and a free hand over preparing a dinner was a joy in itself. At 7:25, the first guest arrived. He spoke with a German accent. "I wish to be taken to room X." The French secretary stiffened involuntarily. "A Bosch," she murmured to the manager, as the first arrival disappeared through the swing doors at the end of the lounge. Almost immediately afterwards, the second and third members of the party arrived. They did not come together and were evidently strangers to one another. The leading one was a tall, gaunt man with a ragged beard and a pair of piercing eyes. As he asked for room X, the little fat man standing just behind him started and shot him a bird-like glance. Then he too asked for room X. "He's not French," said the secretary, as the ill-assorted pair were led out of the lounge by the head waiter. "That last one was another Bosch." The manager thoughtfully twirled his pince-nez between his fingers. "Two Germans and an American." As he spoke, the door again swung open, and a man wearing a soft hat and a thick white scarf, pulled up as almost completely to cover his face, came in. All that the manager could swear to was a pair of deep-set, steel-grey eyes, which seemed to bore through him. "You got my letter this morning?" "Monsieur le Comte de Guy," the manager bowed. "Everything is ready, and your three guests have arrived." "Good. I will go to the room at once." The maître d'hôtel stepped forward. As the count passed through the swing doors, he turned to the head waiter. "After the coffee has been brought in, I do not wish to be disturbed under any circumstances whatever." "Mais certainement, monsieur le comte. I personally will see to it." He flung open the door. It cannot be said that the atmosphere of the room was congenial. The three occupants were regarding one another in hostile silence. For a moment, the count stood motionless while he looked at each one in turn. Then he stepped forward. "Good evening, gentlemen. I am honoured at your presence." He turned to the head waiter. "Let dinner be served in 5 minutes exactly." With a bow, the man left the room. "During that 5 minutes, gentlemen, I propose to introduce myself to you, and you to one another." In silence, the three guests waited while he unwound the thick white muffler. Then, with undisguised curiosity, they studied their host. In profile, his face, with its short, dark beard, was aquiline and stern. The eyes, which had so impressed the manager, seemed now to be a cold grey-blue. The thick brown hair, flecked slightly with grey, was brushed back from a broad forehead. His hands were large and white and capable. The hands of a man who knew what he wanted, knew how to get it, and got it. The count advanced first to the American, holding out his hand. "Mr. Hocking, I believe." The American shook the proffered hand, while the two Germans looked at him with sudden interest. As the head of the great American Cotton Trust, worth more in millions than he could count, he was entitled to their respect. The count turned to the taller of the two Germans. "Herr Steinmann, is it not?" The man, whose interest in German coal was hardly less well-known than Hocking's in cotton, bowed stiffly. And Herr von Gratz? The Count turned to the last member of the party and shook hands. Von Gratz's name in the steel trade in Central Europe was one to conjure with. The nations of the world have recently been engaged in a performance of unrivaled stupidity, said the Count. And when idiots get busy on a large scale, it is time for clever men to step in. That is the raison d'être for this little dinner. Gentlemen, I claim that we four are sufficiently international to be able to disregard any stupid and petty feelings about this country and that country, and to regard the world outlook from one point of view only, our own. As the gaunt American gave a hoarse chuckle, the head waiter opened the door and the four men sat down to dine. Finally, the coffee had been handed round and the door closed behind the waiter. Now, as the Count carefully cut the end of his cigar, he knew that the hardest part of the evening was in front of him. Gentlemen, we are all men of business. He turned to the two Germans. Though the Central Powers have been beaten by America and France and Britain, I believe it is neither France nor America with whom you two gentlemen desire another round. Britain is Germany's main enemy. Both Germans grunted assent. The Count turned to the American. Mr. Hocking, I have reason to believe that you personally do not love the British. I don't see what my private feelings have to do with it, but you are correct in your belief. Good. Gentlemen, what I am about to put before you is the defeat of Britain. A defeat more utter and complete than if she had lost the war. Don't think that I am proposing this merely through motives of revenge. We are businessmen, and revenge is worth our while only if it pays. This will pay. There is a force in Britain which, if harnessed and led properly, will result in millions coming to you. Harness that force, gentlemen, and use it for your own ends. Not only will you humble that cursed country to the dirt, but you will taste of power such as few men have tasted before. The Count stood up, his eyes blazing. And I will do it for you. He resumed his seat and leaned forward, glancing at the intent faces of his audience. Then he began to speak. 10 minutes later, he pushed back his chair. There is my proposal, gentlemen, in a nutshell. What is your answer? He rose and stood by the fire with his back to them. For several minutes, no one spoke. The three men were looking at the hands he had given them. What matter that only a master criminal could have conceived such a game? The only question which occupied their minds was whether he could carry it through. The American leaned back and stretched his legs. Count, you know who we are and what we're worth and all about us. Are you disposed to be a little more communicative about yourself? If we agree to come in on this hand, it's going to cost big money. The handling of that money is with you. Well, who are you? Von Gratz and Steinemann nodded in agreement. The Count turned and faced them. A very fair question, gentlemen, and yet one which I regret I am unable to answer. You will have to trust me, even as I shall have to trust you. You will have to trust me not to divert into my own pocket the money which you give me as working expenses. I shall have to trust you to pay me when the job is finished. And that payment, said Steinemann, that will be how much? £1,000,000 to be paid within 1 month of the completion of my work. After that, the matter will pass into your hands. And may you leave that cursed country groveling in the dirt. Von Gratz spoke. Perhaps, Count, you would be good enough to leave us for a few minutes. Why, certainly, gentlemen. The Count moved towards the door. I will return in 10 minutes. By that time, you will have decided one way or the other. When they had had their 10 minutes, the Count re-entered and crossed to the fireplace. Well, gentlemen, what have you decided? It was the American who answered. We agree with one amendment. The money is too big for the three of us. There must be a fourth. That will be $250,000 each. The Count bowed. And we agree that it should be another of my countrymen. The man we've decided on is coming to England in a few weeks. His name is Hiram C. Potts. If you get him in, you can count us in too. If not, the deal's off. The Count nodded. I know of Mr. Potts. Your big shipping man, isn't he? I agree to your condition. Half an hour later, he entered his luxurious suite of rooms at the Hotel Magnificent. A girl, who had been lying by the fire reading, looked up. Successful, he said. Tomorrow, Irma, the Comte de Guy dies. And Carl Peterson and his daughter leave for England. A country gentleman, I think, is Carl Peterson. He might keep hens and possibly pigs. The girl rose, yawning. Mon Dieu, what a prospect! Pigs and hens, and in England! How long is it going to take? The Count looked thoughtfully into the fire. Perhaps a year. It is in the lap of the gods. Captain Hugh Drummond, DSO, MC, late of His Majesty's Royal Loamshires, was whistling in the morning bath. After a while, the musical gurgle of escaping water announced that the concert was over. It was the signal for James Denny, the square-jawed ex-Batman, to disappear into the back regions and get from his wife the kidneys and bacon which she had grilled to a turn. But on this particular morning, James Denny seemed preoccupied. He was staring out of the window to the other side of Half Moon Street. What are you looking for, James Denny? His wife was at the door. Them kidneys is ready and waiting these 5 minutes. Her eyes fell on the table, and she advanced into the room, wiping her hands on her apron. Did you ever see such a bunch of letters? 45, said her husband, and more to come. He picked up the newspaper lying beside the chair and opened it out. The result of that. He thrust the paper under his wife's nose. Demobilised officer, she read. Finding peace incredibly tedious, would welcome diversion. Legitimate if possible, but crime, if of a comparatively humorous description, no objection. Excitement essential, reply at once box X10. I calls it wicked, she announced. Crime. Don't you have nothing to do with it, Denny, my man, or you and me will be having words. A moment or two later, Hugh Drummond came in. Slightly under 6 feet in height, he was broad in proportion. His best friend would not have called him good-looking, but he was the fortunate possessor of that cheerful type of ugliness which inspires immediate confidence in its owner. His nose had never quite recovered from the final year in the public school's heavyweights, but his eyes, deep-set and steady, showed the man for what he was, a sportsman and a gentleman, and the combination of the two is an unbeatable production. Good morning, Mrs. Denny. Wherefore this worried look on your face? Has that reprobate James been misbehaving himself? She stared pointedly at the letters. He is not, sir. Not yet, leastwise. And she stalked from the room. The two men looked at one another. Is that their reference to crime, sir? Said Denny. That's what's torn it. Hugh helped himself to bacon. Thinks I'm going to lead you astray, does she, James? Well, my dear fellow, she can think what she likes, so long as she continues to grill bacon like this. Your wife, James, is a pearl amongst women, and you can tell her so with my love. He nodded at the letters. Go through them, James, and pick two or three out for me. As a first venture in our new career, ours, I said, James, love appeals to me irresistibly. Find me a damsel in distress, a beautiful girl, helpless in the clutches of knaves. As he finished the last piece of bacon and helped himself to marmalade, his servant, engrossed in a letter he had just opened, suddenly sucked his teeth loudly. His master looked up and removed the letter from his hands. "My dear Box X10, if your advertisement wasn't a joke, you're the man I want. I can offer you excitement and probably crime. I'm up against it, X10. For a girl, I've bitten off rather more than I can chew. I want help, badly. Will you come to the Carlton for tea tomorrow afternoon? I want to see if you are genuine. Wear a white flower in your buttonhole."
Drummond laid the letter down.
"Tomorrow? That's today. This very afternoon. Go out, my trusty fellow, and buy me a daisy or a cauliflower or something white." At 4 o'clock exactly, Hugh Drummond stepped out of his two-seater at the Haymarket entrance to the Carlton. A white gardenia was in his buttonhole. His grey suit looked the last word in exclusive tailoring. For a few moments after entering the hotel, he stood at the top of the stairs outside the dining room, while his eyes travelled round the tables in the lounge below. Suddenly his eyes ceased wandering and remained fixed on a table at the far end of the lounge. Half hidden behind a plant, a girl was seated alone. The table next to her was unoccupied, and Drummond made his way towards it and sat down. He felt not the slightest doubt that this was the girl who had written to him. He could only see her profile, but her eyes were very blue, and great masses of golden brown hair coiled over her ears from under a small black hat. He glanced at her hands and noted with approval the absence of any ring. Then he looked once more at her face and found her eyes fixed on him. Drummond fumbled in his waistcoat pocket. Taking out a card, he propped it up so that the girl could see what was on it. In large block capitals, he had written, "Box X10. She spoke almost at once. "You'll do, X10. Don't look round. And tell me your name quickly."
"Drummond. Captain Drummond, late of the Loamshires."
"My dear Phyllis," said a voice behind his back, "this is a pleasant surprise. I had no idea that you were in London."
A tall, clean-shaven man stopped beside the table, throwing a keen glance at Drummond.
"The world is full of such surprises, isn't it?" said the girl.
"I don't suppose you know Captain Drummond, do you? Mr. Lackington, art connoisseur and collector."
The two men bowed slightly, and it struck Hugh that rarely, if ever, had he seen such a cold, merciless face. Lackington looked at his watch.
"Alas, I must tear myself away. Are you returning home this evening?"
The girl shrugged.
"Probably. I haven't quite decided."
With a bow, Lackington turned away. Drummond noticed that the girl had gone a little white.
"What's the matter? Are you feeling faint?"
"I'm all right. But you've stumbled right into the middle of it, Captain Drummond, rather sooner than I anticipated. That is one of the men you will probably have to kill."
"There's nothing like straightforward candour," he said. "I didn't much care for his face or his manner, but why should I go to so much trouble?"
"First and foremost," said the girl, "the brute wants to marry me."
"I'm not surprised," said Hugh.
"But that isn't what matters." She looked at Drummond. "Henry Lackington is the second most dangerous man in Britain."
"Only the second," murmured Hugh. "Then hadn't I better start my new career with the first?"
She looked at him.
Her blue eyes were very big, and the face they were set in was very charming. Altogether, Drummond reflected, a most adorable girl.
"Tell me all about it," he said. "I'd better start with the sort of men you're up against. Firstly, Henry Lackington, the man who spoke to me. He was, I believe, a brilliant scientist. But he deliberately chose to turn his brain to crime. He regards crime as something to be treated as a mathematical problem. He is quite unscrupulous. He's only concerned in pitting himself against the world and winning."
"Why don't you tell the police?" said Hugh.
"Because I've got no proof. But one day, my father and I were in his house, and by accident, I got into a strange room with two large safes let into the wall and steel bars over the skylight in the ceiling. On the desk in the middle of the room lay some miniatures, and I picked them up. To my horror, I recognised them. Do you remember the theft of the celebrated Vatican miniatures belonging to the Duke of Melbourne?"
Drummond nodded.
"They were the ones I was holding in my hand," she said. I knew them at once from the description in the papers, and just as I was wondering what on earth to do, the man himself walked into the room.
Awkward, said Drummond. What did he do?
Nothing. Admiring my treasures, he remarked. Wonderful copies of the Duke of Melbourne's lost miniatures. I think they would deceive most people. They deceived me, I managed to say. He went over to one of the safes and unlocked it.
Come here, Miss Benton, he said. There are a lot more copies.
I looked inside only for a moment. Beautifully arranged on black velvet shelves were ropes of pearls, a gorgeous diamond tiara, and a whole heap of loose, uncut stones. Then he shut the door and locked it.
All copies, he said. And should you ever be tempted to think otherwise, ask your father, Miss Benton.
And did you? Said Drummond. She shuddered.
That very evening, and Daddy flew into a frightful passion and told me never to dare meddle in things that didn't concern me again, I realised that Lackington had some hold over Daddy, that he'd got my father in his power.
Her hands were clenched.
That's not all. There was a man called George Dringer, and one evening, when Lackington was dining with us, I heard him discussing this man with Daddy.
He's got to go, said Lackington. He's dangerous.
And then my father got up and closed the door, but I heard them arguing for half an hour. 3 weeks later, a coroner's jury found that George Dringer had committed suicide. There was another case, she said. Do you remember that man who was found dead in a railway carriage at Oxy Station? He was an Italian, Giuseppe by name, and the jury brought in a verdict of death from natural causes. A month before, he'd met Lackington at our house by chance. We lived next door to Lackington, and being a stranger, he'd come to the wrong house. Lackington happened to be with us at the time. The interview finished with a fearful quarrel.
She turned to Drummond.
I know Lackington murdered him.
Drummond did not answer immediately. What about this other man? He asked at length. The one you consider more dangerous still.
I can tell you very little about him. He came to the Elms, that's the name of Lackington's house, 3 months ago. His name's Peterson. He's about medium height, rather thick-set, clean-shaven, with thick brown hairs, flecked slightly with white. His eyes are a sort of cold grey-blue, but it's his hands that terrify me. They're large and white and utterly ruthless. He frightens me to death. He would stop at nothing to gain his ends. Even Lackington himself knows that Mr. Peterson is master.
Peterson, murmured Drummond.
A sound old English name.
Oh, the name is sound enough, but it's about as real as his daughter.
There's a lady in the case, then?
By the name of Irma. She lies on a sofa in the garden and yawns. She's no more English than that waiter.
And what is it that makes you think there's mischief ahead?
Because my father hardly ever sleeps at night now. I hear him pacing up and down, hour after hour. I've just got to find out what the trouble is. I've got to get him away from those devils before he breaks down completely.
We'd better go, said Drummond. My address is 60A Half Moon Street. My telephone is Mayfair 1234. If anything happens, if ever you want me, at any hour of the day or night, ring me up. If I'm not in, leave a message with my servant, Denny. He is absolutely reliable. The only other thing is your address.
The Larches near Godalming, answered the girl as they moved towards the door.
Oh, if you only knew the glorious relief of feeling I've got someone to turn to. May I drop you anywhere? He asked as they stood on the pavement. She shook her head.
No, thank you. I'll take that taxi.
She gave the driver an address and stepped in. While I think of it, said Hugh. We're old friends. Can that be done? In case I come and stay, you see? She nodded. All right. We met a lot in London during the war. She drove off, leaving Hugh with a vivid picture imprinted on his mind of blue eyes and white teeth and a skin like the bloom of a sun-kissed peach. Next afternoon, Drummond's two-seater made short work of the run to Godalming.
Under the dicky seat lay a small bag, and as Drummond thought of the two guns rolled up carefully in his pyjamas, he grinned gently. The girl had not rung him up during the morning, and after a comfortable lunch at his club, he'd started about 3 o'clock. The persistent honking behind caused him to pull into the side of the road. An open, cream-coloured Rolls-Royce drew level with 5 people on board. There were 3 people in the back, 2 men and a woman. And for a moment his eyes met those of the man nearest him. Then they drew ahead. With a slight frown, he stared at the retreating car. The man whose eye he had caught as the Rolls went by was Henry Lackington. There was no mistaking that hard-lipped, cruel face. Presumably, thought Hugh, the other 2 occupants of the back seat were Mr. Peterson and the doubtful daughter, Irma. He followed in the big car's wake, accelerating up the hill. The next moment, he braked hard and pulled up just in time. The Rolls, with the chauffeur peering into the bonnet, had stopped in such a position that it was impossible for him to get by. The girl was still seated in the back of the car, also the passenger in front, but the 2 other men were standing in the road. Lackington came towards him.
"I'm so sorry," he began.
"Why? Surely it's Captain Drummond." The other man was now approaching, and Drummond regarded him curiously.
"Peterson," said Lackington as he came up, "this is a friend of our little Phyllis. I found them having tea together yesterday at the Carlton."
Peterson smiled. "Any friend of Miss Benton's is, I hope, ours." "I wonder if I could help your chauffeur," said Hugh. "I'm a bit of an expert with the Rolls." "How very kind of you," said Peterson. "I'll go and see." He went over to the man. "Who's the quaint bird sitting beside the chauffeur?" said Hugh. "Wish to heaven I'd had a few more like him in France to turn into snipers."
"Why do you think he would have been a success at the job?" said Lackington.
"Because he's so motionless. Bally fellow hasn't moved a muscle since I've been here. Great gift, Mr. Lackington." Peterson called.
"All's well."
And Lackington buttoned his coat. "So long," said Hugh. "Hope you don't break down again so suddenly." A few minutes later, he was ringing the front doorbell at the Larches. The maid ushered him into the drawing room and closed the door. It was a charming room. French windows led out onto a lawn, a few oak trees threw a pleasant shade at the end of the garden, and partially showing through them, he could see another house, which he rightly assumed was the Elms. In fact, even as he heard the door open and shut behind him, he saw Peterson come out of a small summer house smoking a cigar. He turned and faced Phyllis Benton.
"Oh, why have you come here, Captain Drummond?" she said. "It's terribly dangerous for you. If once those men suspect anything, God knows what will happen. They are so utterly unscrupulous, so fiendishly clever, that even you would be like a child in their hands."
That was the first chapter of Bulldog Drummond by Herman McNeil, otherwise known as Sapper, read by Julian Ryan Tutt, abridged by Neville Teller, and produced by John Simpson.